Welcome back to another deep dive. Last time we laid the groundwork for how to train massive language models covering data parallelism, tensor parallelism, sequence parallelism, and context parallelism, and even ring attention.
Oh, wow. That's a lot of parallelism.
Haha, it is, yeah. Today we're going even deeper, diving into pipeline parallelism.
Okay.
Which is a crucial technique for distributing model training across multiple GPUs.
Yeah, pipeline parallelism is it's really all about efficiency, right?
Okay.
By splitting a model's layers across multiple GPUs and creating a computational pipeline, we can tackle these massive models that simply wouldn't fit on a single GPU.
So instead of like replicating the entire model on each GPU, we're dividing the workload.
Exactly.
With each GPU handling a specific stage of the model's processing. That sounds like a really smart way to distribute the computational burden, but are we just like shifting the bottleneck?
That is a great question, and that's where things can get a little tricky. While pipeline parallelism can significantly reduce the amount of data that each GPU needs to communicate at once, it does introduce a new challenge, which we call the bubble problem.
The bubble problem.
Yeah, the bubble problem. So imagine a four-stage pipeline, right?
Okay.
The first GPU completes its forward pass, but then it just sits there idle, waiting for the other three stages to finish.
Oh, okay.
Before it can start the next batch of data. This idle time, this waiting time, that's the bubble.
Okay, so as we add more stages, does this bubble grow?
Exactly, yeah. As we add more stages, this bubble grows, and that reduces our overall efficiency.
So it's like an air bubble in a real pipeline, you know, disrupting the smooth flow of data. Is there a way to, like, quantify this bubble effect?
Absolutely. We can define the bubble mathematically. It's essentially the difference between the total time taken for a batch to pass through the pipeline and the ideal time if there were no idle periods. So the larger the bubble, the greater the inefficiency.
Okay, I'm starting to get it. So how do we like tackle this bubble? How do we optimize the flow of computations in a pipeline parallelism setup?
Well, one approach is to use some clever scheduling schemes. Instead of waiting for all the forward passes to complete before starting the backward passes, we can overlap them.
So we're kind of interweaving the forward and backward passes to make better use of those idle GPUs.
Exactly, yeah. There are actually several different pipeline parallelism schemes that we can use, each with its own pros and cons. The simplest one is called all forward, all backward, or AFAB.
AFAB, okay. That sounds pretty straightforward. What's the catch?
Well, in AFAB, we complete all the forward passes sequentially, followed by all the backward passes.
Okay.
So it's pretty easy to implement, but it can lead to a memory bottleneck because we have to store all the activations from the forward passes until the backward pass, which can be a huge drain on memory, especially for large models.
Ah, so it's like trying to cram a massive data set into limited GPU memory. Not very efficient.
Exactly.
Is there a way to manage that, this memory explosion?
Yeah, so there's another scheme that addresses this memory issue called one forward, one backward, or 1F1B. Instead of waiting for all the forward passes, we start a backward pass as soon as the first stage completes its forward pass.
Okay.
So we're overlapping them a little bit. This reduces the amount of activation data that we need to store at any given time.
So we're trading memory efficiency for a bit more complexity?
Exactly.
1F1B commonly used?
Yeah, actually it is. It's the approach that's used in Llama 3.1.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So this scheme demonstrates a conscious decision to prioritize memory efficiency, even at the cost of increased scheduling complexity.
Interesting. So choosing a scheduling scheme seems to always involve a trade-off between implementation complexity and memory management. Are there other schemes out there beyond AFAB and 1F1B?
There are, yeah. Interleaved stages is another technique, offers a different approach to minimizing the bubble.
Okay.
Instead of neatly dividing the model layers across GPUs, we interleave them.
So instead of layers 1 to 4 on GPU 1 and then 5 to 8 on GPU 2, we might mix them up.
Precisely. This interleaving allows for a tighter overlap between forward and backward passes, which further reduces the bubble size. But of course, there's a trade-off.
I'm guessing this interleaving introduces more frequent communication between the GPUs because the data needs to, like, jump around more.
Exactly. Finding the right balance between minimizing the bubble and managing communication costs is key to optimizing pipeline parallelism.
Sounds like a delicate dance.
It is.
Are there any other, like, really advanced techniques that push the boundaries even further?
There are some really cutting-edge approaches out there, like zero bubble and dual pipe.
Oh, I've heard of those.
Yeah, zero bubble breaks down computations into even finer-grained operations, allowing for incredibly precise scheduling to minimize idle time. And then dual pipe, which is used in DeepSeek v3, takes this concept further by creating two streams of data flowing in opposite directions through the pipeline.
Wow, these techniques sound incredibly sophisticated. Are they commonly used in large language model training?
They're gaining traction as researchers continue to push the limits of model size and training speed. You know, these advanced techniques highlight the constant innovation in this field.
Always striving for greater efficiency.
Exactly.
So we've got this spectrum of pipeline parallelism schemes, each with its own unique approach to managing that bubble in communication costs. But how do we choose the right scheme for a specific model and hardware setup?
That's a great question, and it leads us into the next layer of this discussion, because choosing the right pipeline parallelism scheme is only one piece of the puzzle. We need to consider the broader context of available resources, model architecture, and our training goals.
Okay, I'm ready to dive deeper. Let's explore those factors and see how they influence our choices in pipeline parallelism and beyond.
Sounds good. So choosing the optimal pipeline parallelism strategy is just the tip of the iceberg, right? We need to consider the entire landscape of parallelism techniques to efficiently train these massive language models.
So it's not just about like picking one technique, but rather orchestrating like a symphony of parallelism strategies all working together in harmony.
Exactly. It's about understanding the interplay between different techniques and selecting the best combination for our specific needs.
Okay, let's like map out this landscape a bit.
Sure.
We've talked about data parallelism, tensor parallelism, sequence parallelism, and now pipeline parallelism. How do these all work together?
Think of it like a toolbox. You know, each parallelism technique offers a unique way to distribute the computations and manage resources.
Okay.
And pipeline parallelism excels at reducing communication bandwidth between stages, but it introduces that bubble problem that we talked about.
Right, and we discussed different schemes like 1F1B or interleaved stages trying to mitigate that bubble, but where do techniques like data parallelism and tensor parallelism fit into this pipeline?
They play a crucial role in how we distribute data and computations across our GPUs. Data parallelism focuses on processing different batches of data in parallel, while tensor parallelism shards the model's parameters and activations across multiple GPUs.
So we can imagine data parallelism working alongside pipeline parallelism. Each stage in the pipeline might be further parallelized using data parallelism to process even larger batches of data.
Exactly. And tensor parallelism can be applied within each stage as well, further distributing that computational load. We can even combine tensor parallelism with sequence parallelism.
Oh, right.
Which divides the processing of sequences across GPUs, allowing us to handle longer sequences efficiently.
It's getting complicated. We've got these different dimensions of parallelism all interacting and overlapping. It feels like there's a combinatorial explosion of possibilities.
There is, and that's why choosing the optimal training configuration is so challenging.
And fascinating.
Yes, and fascinating. We need to consider not only the individual strengths and weaknesses of each technique, but also how they interact, how they complement each other.
So it's not just about throwing more GPUs at the problem, but strategically leveraging these techniques to maximize efficiency. What are some of the guiding principles when navigating this complex landscape?
One really important consideration is the type of model that we're training. For models with billions of parameters but relatively short sequences, a combination of data parallelism and tensor parallelism might be enough. We can use techniques like 0-3 to partition the model weights and optimizer states across GPUs, minimizing memory redundancy.
0-3, yeah, we touched on that briefly, right, when we were comparing it to pipeline parallelism.
Exactly. It's a powerful technique for reducing memory requirements and enabling us to train larger models.
Okay.
While pipeline parallelism divides the model by layer, 0-3 partitions model weights across GPUs. They're both aiming to distribute the model, but they take different approaches.
So pipeline parallelism focuses on creating that computational pipeline, while ZR03 focuses on minimizing memory redundancy. What are the trade-offs between these two approaches?
Well, pipeline parallelism can be more communication efficient for models with really giga architectures, but it introduces the bubble problem. ZR03, on the other hand, avoids the bubble, but it involves more frequent communication of weights during training.
The classic trade-off between communication frequency and computational efficiency. It seems like there's no clear winner, and the optimal choice just depends on the specific scenario.
Exactly. And as models become even larger and more complex, like those with hundreds of billions or even trillions of parameters, we often need to combine multiple parallelism techniques to effectively distribute the workload.
So we might use pipeline parallelism to divide the model across multiple nodes, with each node further leveraging data parallelism and tensor parallelism to handle the computations within its stage. It's like a hierarchical structure, optimizing data flow based on the speed and bandwidth of the connections.
Exactly. We're building this sophisticated communication hierarchy, strategically leveraging different parallelism strategies based on their strengths and limitations. And there are even more specialized techniques like context parallelism and expert parallelism that address specific challenges.
Context parallelism that was designed for handling those extremely long sequences, right? We see those in some of the modern language models. It shards activations along the sequence dimension, enabling us to work with sequences that might be too large to fit in memory otherwise.
Exactly. And techniques like ring attention can further optimize communication within context parallelism, minimizing the overhead of sharing information across the distributed activations.
And what about expert parallelism? That one's still a bit fuzzy for me.
Expert parallelism, or EP, is specifically designed for mixture of experts models.
MOE.
Yeah, MOE, where we have multiple specialized experts within each layer handling different types of input. EP allows us to distribute these experts across different GPUs, enabling us to scale MOE models to incredible sizes.
So it's like having a team of specialists, each with their own dedicated processing unit, tackling different aspects of the input data. Sounds very efficient.
It is, but it's important to remember that EP alone only addresses the expert distribution. We need to combine it with other techniques like data parallelism to efficiently process the input batches and manage the overall data flow.
Okay, it's all starting to come together now. We've got this pool box of parallelism techniques, each addressing specific challenges and offering unique advantages. The art lies in selecting the right combination and orchestrating them to work in harmony.
That's the essence of distributed training for large language models. It's a dance between understanding the intricacies of our models, the capabilities of our hardware, and the demands of our training goals.
It sounds like this dance is constantly evolving as researchers push the boundaries of what's possible. But let's shift gears for a moment. Assuming we've mapped out our parallelism strategy, how do we actually go about choosing the optimal configuration for a specific training run? What are the key factors we need to consider? So we've explored this like vast landscape of parallelism techniques, and we've seen how pipeline parallelism, data parallelism, tensor parallelism, sequence parallelism, even context parallelism and expert parallelism all play unique roles in like distributing the workload and tackling those challenges of training these massive language models.
It's like assembling a team of specialized experts,
Right.
each with their strengths and weaknesses. And the art is in understanding those nuances and how to orchestrate them, how to get them to work together seamlessly.
But how do we move from this high-level understanding to like actually configuring a training run? Where do we even begin?
Well, the first step is actually pretty straightforward.
Okay.
Can we fit a single training step into memory? We need to make sure that even a single instance of our model, along with all the necessary optimizer states and activations, can reside on our available GPUs.
So before we even think about parallelism, we need to make sure our hardware can handle the basic memory requirements.
Exactly.
What if we're working with limited resources? Like, what if our model, even just one instance, is too big for our GPUs?
That's where things get interesting. We can employ techniques like activation recomputation,
Okay.
where we just recalculate activations during the backward pass instead of storing them. So we're trading compute for memory savings. Another powerful tool is gradient accumulation, which allows us to simulate larger batch sizes by accumulating gradients over multiple mini batches.
So we're essentially stretching our resources, right? Employing these clever tricks to overcome the memory limitations. But assuming we've managed to like fit our model into memory, what's the next step in configuring our training run?
Then we need to think about the global batch size.
Okay.
This determines how much data we process in each training step and directly impacts the training speed and efficiency.
Right, the batch size, that's like a crucial knob to tune, right? Balancing the speed of the training with the resource constraints. How do we determine the optimal batch size for a specific setup?
Well, there are a few things to consider. If we have ample GPU memory and communication bandwidth isn't a bottleneck, we can aim for a larger global batch size, which often leads to faster training. And we can achieve this by scaling up data parallelism or using gradient accumulation.
So if we're lucky enough to be in like a GPU-rich scenario, we can push for those larger batches and potentially accelerate training. But what if we're working with more limited resources, a GPU-poor scenario?
Right, well, then we might need to decrease that global batch size to fit within our memory constraints. Reducing data parallelism or adjusting gradient accumulation can help us achieve that balance. And for models with long sequences, adjusting context parallelism can further optimize memory usage.
Okay, so we fit the model into memory, we fine-tune the batch size. What's the final piece of the puzzle?
Optimizing for training throughput. We want our GPUs working as efficiently as possible, you know, crunching through the data, updating the model weights at the fastest possible rate.
Throughput is king.
Exactly. So how do we squeeze the most performance out of our hardware? Well, if memory and communication aren't bottlenecks, we can scale up tensor parallelism within a node.
Okay.
Minimizing the need for other, potentially more communication-intensive parallelism techniques, increasing data parallelism with 0.3 while maintaining our target batch size can also significantly boost throughput.
So we're pushing different levers, strategic balancing parallelism strategies to maximize the efficiency of our training pipeline.
Exactly. And as data parallelism communication starts to become a bottleneck, we can transition to pipeline parallelism, you know, distributing the model across multiple nodes, alleviating some of that pressure.
So it's like a dynamic process, constantly evaluating and adjusting our parallelism strategy based on performance feedback.
Exactly.
The goal is to find that sweet spot where all of our resources are humming along in perfect harmony. Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground in this deep dive.
We have.
From, like, understanding the fundamentals of pipeline parallelism to navigating the complex interplay of all these different parallelism strategies, we've gained, I think, a really deep appreciation for the challenges and innovations involved in training these massive language models that are really reshaping our world.
And it doesn't end here. Research in parallelism for large language models is a rapidly evolving field, with new techniques and optimizations emerging all the time.
Right.
As models continue to grow in size and complexity, the demand for efficient and scalable training methods will only intensify.
So as you continue exploring this fascinating world of large language models, remember the intricate dance of parallelism that makes it all possible?
Exactly.
Think about the strategic decisions involved in, like, distributing those billions of parameters.
Yes.
Managing communication bottlenecks, optimizing for speed and efficiency.
And keep in mind that there's no one-size-fits-all solution.
Right.
The optimal approach depends on a delicate balance of factors. The model architecture, the available hardware, the desired training speed, and even the characteristics of the data itself.
And above all, stay curious.
Yes.
Dive deep into the research, experiment with different techniques, and contribute to this incredible evolution of this exciting field.
Until next time, keep exploring, keep learning, and keep pushing the boundaries of what's possible with large language models.
This is The Deep Dive, signing off.